Terry offered me a lift in his Volkswagen caravan. Not wanting to trouble him unnecessarily and thinking that perhaps he could drop me at a convenient underground station, I asked him how far in the direction of the Vihara he was willing to drive. "I can drive you as far as you like," was the cheerful response. "Could you drive me to India?" I asked, the words springing unpremeditated to my lips. "Yes," he replied, his face lighting up, "I could." Thus began a friendship that was to have important consequences for the rest of my life, and through me, for the future of British Buddhism. So that's Bante talking about his friendship with Terry Delamere, which you may not have heard of Terry Delamere, but it's a very close friendship. And I guess I was just really struck by that, because he doesn't say why he thinks that particular friendship had such an impact on his understanding of Buddhism, and therefore what he's kind of drawn out for us. But I think the reason why, because in a way you could say that, well, friendship is not a distinctive emphasis of Tree Ratna. It's not distinctive to Tree Ratna. It's there throughout the Pali Canon. It's there to be found in Tibetan Buddhism. Often it's implicit. It needs a bit of digging, but it's there. So you could sort of say that it's not really a distinctive emphasis of Tree Ratna. But Bante is saying that this particular friendship kind of extended his understanding of the significance of it in Buddhism, I think that's what he's saying. And that left me thinking, well, what was it about that friendship? And I think hearing from other people, it seemed like that particular friendship for Bante was his first sort of close, deep friendship. So he talked of his teacher, Dada Rinpoche, as a friend. He said he became his teacher without ceasing to be his friend. But that's what I think is meant by us talking about this as sort of distinctive emphasis. Like Sangharakshita has taken friendship much, much further than the sort of implicit coverage that it gets in the Pali canon. So that's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about that, how kind of close, deep friendship is significant, essentially, to the Buddhist path. And I also want to talk about my second point, if you like, is about how friendship is kind of a key to resolving the problem of the teacher. As Maitri Bandhu talks about it, he talks about teachers as a problem. There is a kind of problem, but I'll say more about that. So here goes. But I wanted to start talking actually about loneliness, to kind of step back from the significance of friendship in Buddhism and just look at the significance of friendship in life. There was a documentary on iPlayer about a couple of months ago, which I actually initially I looked at and I thought that might be interesting, but then I thought probably it will be lots of old people who are not very, you know, who are lonely. I confess, that's I thought I don't want to spend my kind of spare hours kind of watching that. It'd be a bit miserable. And then Artapriya, terrible, isn't it? Artapriya said to me that he'd watched it and he said it's really, really good. And one of the things, I don't know how many people saw that, but what was very, very striking about it was that it was not just old people by any means. It was the whole range, the whole age range. So there was a young student talking about kind of holding herself up in her room for days because she was kind of lonely. She didn't really have friends, and the only sort of contact she had was sort of Facebook. And of course, nobody says on Facebook, "I'm feeling lonely," which compounds your sort of sense of loneliness. There was another woman, a very successful woman, who her relationship had finished, and she found herself lonely. Successful job, successful career woman, found herself lonely. She had no other strong friends in her life. So when a relationship broke down, she just found herself in a position of loneliness. There's another guy who, tragic, very poignant. He said, he's the sort of guy you can imagine coming along to a centre. He's kind of seemed like kind of intelligent guy. But he said he'd struggled with work, and he ended up... he actually said the reason why he'd agreed to do the interview was because he was lonely. He'd get a bit of contact through doing it. It's kind of tragic, isn't it? But kind of good, you know, sort of, it seemed like a good man. Anyway, so it's just very, very striking. They're kind of talking of loneliness as an epidemic, this kind of epidemic of loneliness in our world, in our society. So it kind of speaks of something about our society, doesn't it, that is the case. Speaks of a kind of, if you like, putting it in strong terms, kind of slightly sick society, slightly sort of ill society in certain ways. There are kind of views that are leading to the fact that society is kind of like that. So I want to start talking just a bit in that kind of broader context, because I think it's really important, isn't it? Just that basic human reality of kind of connection and loneliness. So when I first... This talk is going to be quite biographical. I'm going to talk initially about... horizontal or peer friendship, significance of that, and then move on to vertical or friendship with the more experienced. So when I first came along to a Buddhist centre, I was kind of searching for something. When I got given the name Vinyasa Priya, it sort of immediately struck home for me. I thought, well, yes, I can see that. I had ideas of kind of developing my mind, of learning to meditate, of kind of new perspectives. Friendship was a long way from my mind. It didn't really occur to me that was going to be sort of part of the deal. But it, for me, it's ironic because actually my questing, my sort of searching for meaning was germinated in friendship. It was a kind of close peer friendship that had really sort of... sparked that off for me. I think without that friendship I probably wouldn't be here actually. So there was a kind of mismatch in a way between what had actually got me here and what I was looking for. But what I encountered was people working together in a way that I'd not experienced before. I couldn't put my finger on what it was, but there was something about the way these people were kind of working together. It was in Sheffield, the guy leading the classes, Amoga Vangsa. I'm not sure how much I learned about meditation in those meditation classes, but I was sold on what was going on. You know, it was fascinating actually. I was kind of, what is this? This is brilliant. So what was that actually? What is it that makes Buddhism? What is Buddhism? You know, we do all these practices, don't we? Kind of meditation. Now we're saying kind of friendship's a part of it. Ethics. There's nothing kind of distinctively Buddhist about those things. So what is it about Buddhism that makes it Buddhism? when I went to the centre, as I say, I was just sold. There was something going on. There was something going on in those classes. There was a particular sort of atmosphere that I did not understand, but I was kind of hooked. And many people kind of talk about this, kind of going along to a centre and kind of being hooked. There's just something going on that you can't quite put your finger on. Well, that atmosphere, in a way, that kind of is Buddhism. It's like there is a vision that the people sort of engaging at the centre have that you pick up on. You don't know what it is, but you kind of pick up on. It's that kind of distinctive spirit with which people are sort of engaging with those practices that makes meditation Buddhist meditation. We're, we just had a break. We're having a break in our Mitra study, but just we had a break of a couple of weeks in our Mitra study group, and people were saying how they kind of missed it, and that actually it wasn't just that they kind of missed it. Oh, that, you know, it was nice, enjoyed, but actually it sort of had effect on their lives at some level. You know, they'd found that their practice had kind of lost a certain sort of certain edge, which is just what I experienced. So. It's very hard to sort of pin down quite what that is, but that's kind of what Buddhism is. So you can talk about it in terms of it's a kind of atmosphere of self-transcendence. There's a sort of spirit of self-transcendence with which we engage with the practices, which is what kind of makes them Buddhism. In a way, you could say all the Dharma is trying to say is it's inviting us to look at life from the perspective of self not being kind of the centre, not being the most important thing. Can you hear me all right from Bandhu?
Some words.
Some words, okay. The thing about atmosphere is you kind of pick it up and it's quite vivid. But it's very elusive. We don't quite know what it is. So, of course, kind of we need to sort of deepen our appreciation of what that is, our understanding, which, of course, is what kind of study is about. So after, I don't know how long, actually, Amoghavangsa invited me to join a pre-Mitra study group. It was with him and Sthirananda, two massively different characters. We started studying the Noble Eightfold Path. Does anyone remember what time I started? Arjuna, what time did I start?
Probably about 8 o'clock.
8 o'clock?
7 o'clock?
7 o'clock,
no,
8 o'clock. 8 o'clock, okay. So there we were, studying the Noble Eightfold Path. I was like, great, I'm going to get some of the answers, you know, find out what this Buddhism is really about. And we started with perfect vision or kind of right view. So this is this kind of vision. The Buddhist vision. So I was delighted. I was going to kind of get to grips with what it was, what it really is, and then I was going to kind of take that idea and go away and kind of get enlightened or something like that. In a way, my sort of attitude was quite sort of consumerist in a way. Knowledge, we've got such access, haven't we, these days to knowledge, and it can lead to a particular type of relationship with knowledge, sort of appropriative sort of relationship. Traditionally in Buddhism, that would not be the case. You'd go and live with your teacher. And it might be weeks before you kind of hear anything. Anyway, I was really keen to be finding out the answers. What I got confronted with after a bit was this idea that right view is right, not just on the basis of its content, its kind of accuracy, also on the basis of kind of how we hold that view. So if we're kind of holding a Buddhist view wrongly, if the attitude with which we're kind of holding it is graspy or something, if we're holding onto it too tightly, it becomes a wrong view. And I was totally kind of stopped in my tracks by that. I was sort of totally, that's amazing. I was totally kind of mind-boggled by that. I suppose I just kind of had a sort of... I want to kind of understand this sort of view, a sort of Western philosophical. I was going to kind of understand it, see how it worked, and kind of go away and sort of then I got it sort of thing. And I was thrilled actually by this possibility. It was like it made me sort of have to let go of that sort of life as problem sort of way of relating to the Dharma. That I was going to kind of work out, I was going to kind of fathom it. And at the same time, I was really frustrated by it because I knew in that moment that I could not do that. I was kind of very attached to the uh, to views, I was not actually at that time sort of able to let go, hold more lightly to views. So the reason for that was to do with the sort of the particular experience of self that I had at the time. So my experience of self was quite tight in a way, quite tight and restricted. And that was to do with the way I was kind of living my life, really. So I was living with student friends at the time, and I'd kind of go and find out about Buddhism. I'd go home and I kind of tell them about Buddhism. In the end, they got really quite fed up with Buddhism. I think basically they were quite threatened by it. At a certain level, they were kind of threatened by it. They were kind of students who were kind of living quite hedonistic life, and I'd sort of come back and kind of talk about this and talk about that. And I think at a certain level, they were just sort of threatened by this kind of rather strange interest that I had. So they'd kind of, you know, they'd argue back or mock it or something, and then I'd sort of, I'd get a bit defensive or wouldn't want to talk about what I was doing. And so there was this, you know, they're friendly enough guys, most of them. One of them threatened to punch me because I suggested he wasn't doing enough washing up. But apart from that, though, but there was just this sort of atmosphere of kind of sort of needing to sort of defend yourself at a certain level. There wasn't a sort of a self-aware, the way we were sort of interacting wasn't leading to kind of a relaxation of self. It was leading to kind of holding on to my position more tightly. I'd then go and work in the evolution shop at the time, and I'd relax and kind of self would expand. So because of this sort of the way I was experiencing self, in a way I didn't have the sort of room to work on my attitudes, if you like. I was kind of holding on at a certain sort of in a certain defensive way to self, and that was the way I was holding on to sort of views and stuff. So what I sort of felt like, it was a bit like a Mogavanksa had put his arm around me and he'd said, Meghia. He kind of called me Meghia. So I wanted to talk about the Meghia Sutta. So if you've not heard of the Meghia Sutta, it's from the Pali Canon. And it's about this young man who is the attendant of the Buddha. And he's looking after the Buddha, if you like. He's helping the Buddha. And he's with the Buddha, and he walks past this beautiful mango grove, and he thinks to himself, wouldn't that be a lovely mango grove to go and meditate, to sort of gain enlightenment? And so he looks for his moment, and he speaks to the Buddha, and he says, Bhagava, I've seen a beautiful mango grove and I would like to go and strive and meditate for enlightenment. And the Buddha brushes him off and says, wait a little, Meghia. It's not timely. There's much to do. Which obviously kind of Meghia is a bit sort of taken aback by. So he asks again. And the Buddha again says, wait a little, Meghia. Third time he asks again, and this time he says, it's okay for you because you're enlightened, but I'm not. And the Buddha says, well, Meghia, what can I say when you talk of striving for enlightenment? Go off and meditate. So he lets him go off and meditate, and then in the process of his meditating in the mango grove, his mind is assailed by kind of lust and thoughts of lust and hatred, which totally surprises him. And he goes back to the Buddha and he says, this is what's happened. And the Buddha says to him, Meghia, when the heart's release is immature, there are these five things that conduce to its maturity. And the first thing he mentions is friendship. Friendship, ethics, talk on the Dharma, meditation and insight. But the emphasis is on friendship. So I sort of feel at some level that I was being interacted with like that. I was kind of going for it in a way that, you know, this was valuable. But I needed to develop my context. The sort of sense of self I had was actually it was limiting me from even simply understanding what Buddhism was about. Yeah, so that's the kind of point I want to draw out, that actually just to really sort of understand, get what this strange, this and wonderful atmosphere is, we can't grasp it merely intellectually. So right view is not merely sort of intellectual. Maitreya Bandhu talks about this in a great way. He talks about when you come off retreat, and you're inspired and you're kind of seeing life in a new way. You're seeing it in a more sort of Buddhist way. And you kind of tell your friends about it. And then 2 weeks later, it's kind of changed. You can remember the ideas, but something's gone. They're kind of empty. The words are sort of empty. So it's not just about ideas, it's also about kind of attitude. View is kind of deeper than ideas, even though that's part of it. So in order to sort of get a glimpse, get an understanding of what Buddhism is talking about, we need to kind of work on attitude. And friendship is the way to work on attitude. So I want to say a little bit more about this, how friendship is a way of working on attitude. So Bante's reflections on the sutta, which I can't remember the name of, but it's very well known, that in which Ananda says Bhagavan, the friendship must be the half of the spiritual life, and the Buddha says no, it's the whole of the spiritual life. So Bante, in a talk that he gave in Germany, is kind of reflecting on that and draws out, well, what does that mean? What did the Buddha really mean by that? And he says, well, the word that he used for the spiritual life is the brahmacharya. So Brahma means the kind of sublime world, sometimes the deathless, so the holy sort of spiritual. But Charya is kind of faring, so the life that kind of fares towards the sublime realm. That's what sort of Brahmacharya means. And in another sutta, the Maha Govinda Sutta, the Buddha is asked, well, how do we do this? And he says, essentially, it's giving up ego. So Bante is drawing from that friendship essentially is a training in egolessness. It's a kind of training in egolessness. So as much with the Dharma, when we're studying, we're kind of training to look in terms of egolessness. In friendship, we're training to live, to emote in an egoless way. So the both are kind of important. And as I said, in traditional Buddhism, this would just be a given that you would kind of join a community if you wanted to get interested in Buddhism. You kind of join a community. The Buddha was saying, Meghya, friendship. You need to start with friendship. So I want to talk a bit about how friendship, in a way it's obvious, isn't it, how friendship is a training in selflessness, but I want to talk nonetheless a bit about how it's a training in selflessness, or at least talk about my reflections on that from my experience of friendship. So unfortunately, or fortunately for him, perhaps Ananda Vajra is not here, but I'm going to talk about my friendship with Ananda Vajra, or the then Jonathan, who kind of came and befriended me actually when I moved down to Windhorse, or at least asked me to kind of meet up. It was a few months later when he said to me on a bench down by the river. We were laughing about this the other day. I'm not sure I want to be your friend anymore. We were very, very different. We are very, very different people. So not only were we very, very different, we were kind of more different then. We're sort of more similar now, but we're still very, very different. Not only were we very, very different, but also we were very kind of intensely going for it. We were kind of jumped in the deep end. Deep end for us meant working together, sharing a room together, same GFR group. It was kind of intense. We were kind of eyeball to eyeball, metaphorically, basically. And we were very, very different. Arlen Dimaggio's conception of friendship was kind of like hanging out together, making cups of tea for each other. It had been reefers, but now it was tea. My sort of conception of friendship was kind of intense discussion, intense conversations and stuff. So it was like our notions of friendship just didn't fit together. Nonetheless, we were kind of going for it. So we kind of stuck at it. I think we'd heard that. What had we heard? We'd heard you need to stick at it, I think. Friendship, you need to stick at it. So we did. The thing is, when you're so intensely involved with someone like that, you know, there's so much contact that you can't avoid what's going on. So at some level, we were trying to be sort of nice Buddhists, but underneath there were kind of things stirring. And what started to come up was kind of intense competition. So what it was we were so different that when he was, you know, he'd get kind of a bit of encouragement, a bit of, you know, a compliment, is he doing this well? And I'd be like, oh, he's doing it well, you're kind of, and you know, or I would get kind of that, and he'd be sort of, you know, it was kind of like we were so different, but this sort of tendency to compete was just sort of is just we were young men, you know, that's what happens. Actually, Arta Priya, at that time, went on retreat, and Arta Priya was instrumental, really, in that in us getting beyond that. I think I don't know quite what would have happened if Arta Priya didn't sort of say, "Do you think you might be getting competitive?" Hadn't even occurred to me. I was kind of so sort of busy on being a nice Buddhist, It hadn't even really occurred to me. I'm not very aware. but that was kind of really, really instrumental. What in a way I saw was there was a man who was experiencing so vividly what I was experiencing. We were so different, yet so much the same. And what was also clear was I was kind of wanting encouragement, basically. I was kind of needing a certain encouragement. And when I heard him being encouraged, I thought, oh God, I'm not very good at that. And vice versa. So there was me kind of feeling this need for encouragement quite strongly, actually, whilst confronted with his qualities. And what I had to do was just put my needs, if you like, aside and just encourage him. I just had to kind of turn the sort of self agenda around and just turn it into other agenda. And at the time, this was quite hard. It felt quite hard to do. I wasn't sort of doing it begrudgingly, but it was kind of like, okay, I think you're all right at that. Yeah, you're not bad, you know. So it was quite hard. There was a number of things I just wanted to draw out from this. But it was incredibly rewarding. So what happened was I just experienced. I still don't really know quite what. I suppose it was just love. Actually, it was just this sort of expansive state. Perhaps because of the intensity, it just sort of flipped around, and I just experienced this kind of incredibly expansive. State. And in a way, in that moment, after Priya was reminding me of this, at the time I was thinking, is friendship over-egged? Is it a bit like, you know, actually it's kind of overdone a bit? Yeah, it's kind of important, but is it this important? You know, can I really do this? In that moment, I was convinced. There was no argument that would have kind of convinced me, but in that experience of what you could call a different experience of self. So previously I had a kind of rather sort of, I talked about, you know, rather kind of tighter experience of self. You know, you can sort of experience it even quite physically, sort of a kind of hardening in the heart. And this was just a sort of expansion of self. Suddenly, the way I was living, the attitudes I was living from were not just about me. They were not just centred on me. They were also centred on this other self. So I don't think you can get to that through friendliness. Friendliness is very, very important, of course, friendliness and generosity. But I don't think you get to that sort of intensity of engagement with another self simply through friendliness. I think we need sort of committed friendships. The reason why I think this is that I think what that experience led to was integration and positive emotion, kind of the sort of key stages of the path. First stages of the path in Bhante's system of practice. So I had to acknowledge what was really going on for me. I had to kind of look at my competitiveness, my kind of my need for encouragement. I didn't want to, you know, I wanted to be this kind of nice Buddhist. I didn't want to have kind of have those things going on, and that sort of got mixed up in my being a nice Buddhist in a way. But I had to look at those things, and of course we need to, don't we, in order to move towards selflessness, we need to look at actually where we are, what our sort of our demons are, what's actually happening. And I think this can only I wouldn't say this can only really happen in deep friendship, but what happens with committed friendship. By committed friendship, I mean you need to spend quite a bit of time together. You need to commit time to spending time together. What happens is your private world gets seen into. So our private world is really important. Our private world is where we hold the things that are kind of most close to us. They're so close that we don't see that we're holding them. So by things, I mean kind of views, ways of seeing ourselves, ways of seeing other people. And if you come together regularly with people, those things start to get seen. People will say, "Was there something going on with you?" You know, then, because you seemed a bit kind of, you know, and you're sort of, no, I'm fine. But those things start to get seen. And that's kind of really, really important, because those are often the things that we most need to look at. They're so close to us, as I say, that we don't see them. So this is kind of what blind spots are about. So our blind spots, if we don't get a chance to look at our blind spots, we don't get a prompt to look at our blind spots, we're limited in terms of the integration that we can actually engage with, is then a struggle for selflessness. So that's it. So committing to friendship, you commit to being a friend. Yeah. So instead of kind of exchange mentality, what you're saying is, I'm going to be a friend to you. That's really, really important. And it requires integration, because at times you're not going to want to do that. At times it's not convenient. They're in a bad mood. Ananda Raja used to get in bad moods. it will be unpleasant, it will be inconvenient, but we commit to being a friend rather than having a friend, basically. That's how you develop friendship. So the other aspect is positive emotion. So I think I've already talked about this actually, but you develop a different kind of self, a different sense of self, a more expansive sense of self, a more pliable sense of self, because your life is not centred upon me. It's no longer kind of centred entirely upon me. You can see this with parents, can't you? My sister, my brother, both become parents recently, and something's shifted, something sort of loosened psychically in them. And interestingly, they've both said, no, actually just my sister said, much happier, the happiest time of her life, with a kind of letting go of self being kind of central. It's really interesting. Of course, friendship is more of a test than having children. I mean, well, having children is a massive test, isn't it? There's no doubt about that. But in terms of kind of selflessness, can we befriend people without the aspect of kind of biology, a sort of instinctual aspect that can come into that helps, I imagine, thank God, I've not got kids myself, but helps with kind of parenting. Positive emotion. We start to develop this kind of more subtle sense of self. The other side of it is that Arnand Avadra was really good at some things and I was kind of hopeless at them. So I talked about our difference in notion of friendship. So he was sort of really good at kind of doing things like just making a cup of tea, small acts of kind of service, if you like. Making friendship kind of practical, that was just sort of second nature to him. I was hopeless at that, shamelessly. But because he appreciated that, while I was trying to be a friend to him, so I started doing that. I appreciated it from him, and I started doing that. So in a way, I sort of learned things. So this kind of less this... When we were in this competitive frame of mind, it was like I was too defended to be able to kind of work on my weaknesses. When we sort of opened up into this sort of sense of kind of encouraging each other, I was able to sort of appreciate his strengths and kind of start to sort of be affected by him, by his qualities. So the last thing that I wanted to say about this area is that I just thought it was interesting that the Buddha Sangharakshita talked about friendship rather than meditation as a kind of way of working on attitude. In meditation, we are working on our mental states, aren't we? We are trying to develop more expanded mental states, and that's a kind of important element of it. But I think the thing is, in meditation, sometimes we can think we've had a really big meditation, really transformative meditation, had a big insight. But then what happens when we get back into contact with people? Are we actually more generous? Are we actually more selfless? I think the test as to what we've experienced is friendship, is our relationships with people. I think it's not only that, it's also the fact that this side of insight, we're always moving forward and slipping back. So in a certain way, we don't transform ourselves, do we? We just temporarily sort of move forward. There's always a chance we could be slipping back. I think what happens with friendship is that people get used to you being a certain way, and that's quite helpful. So they expect you, people start to expect you to act in a less selfish way. If you develop friendship, they kind of start to expect you to be a friend at a certain level. And this is kind of quite helpful because we start to develop, in a way, an identity as being that sort of person. And I think, in a way, that's what we're talking about at the early stage of the path as transformation. We're talking about a kind of new identity that other people affirm is actually the case. So I think that's kind of, in the early stages of the path, kind of quite important to help us sort of maintain, consolidate changes of attitude, behaviour. So that's what I wanted to say. That's all I wanted to say, actually, about the significance of friendship in terms of kind of training in selflessness and how unavoidable that is as a practice in terms of just understanding what we're doing in terms of kind of right view, in terms of developing right view. But as I said, I also want to talk about vertical friendship or friendship with people who are further on the path. So, as I mentioned, Artur Pryor has been a really important friend, guide, vertical friend, to me. He was kind of really instrumental in just sort of pointing a few things out where I was kind of going majorly wrong without quite knowing what was going on. Just kind of steering me in the right direction and very, very encouraging. But it wasn't just that. I think with Artur Pryor, I met someone who I just really looked up to. So I just thought, wow, what an impressive man. Very, very helpful. He's sort of very dedicated to kind of helping other people deepen their practice. And, you know, a keen sense of Buddhism, the Dharma. And also good fun. He was kind of, still is, just kind of really good fun, which I found really important as well. So I just kind of really admired Artur Pryor, actually, and just that sort of looking up to someone for me was incredibly important, actually, as a young man. Yeah, and I benefited in all sorts of ways that I haven't really got time to sort of to sum up, to talk about. Yeah, but a debt of gratitude, I say, to Artur Pryor's friendship. but it wasn't all plain sailing. I checked this all out with him before. Particularly after ordination, actually, there were kind of things that started to come up. I started not wanting to spend as much time with Artur Pryor. I didn't even really know quite why that was at the time, actually, and I was a bit nervous about kind of saying it. In fact, I don't think I did really say it. Yeah, but there was one particular story that kind of came to mind in thinking about this time, which is quite difficult. Apparently Trungpa said, having a vertical spiritual friend, he wouldn't use that terminology, I think having a guru is a practice of constant disappointment. That's what he said. So me and Artur have been kind of finding it a bit difficult, haven't we? And I thought I'd started to get a bit of a handle on what that was, what was going on, what were the difficulties. And so we went out for a walk somewhere, I can't remember exactly where it was, actually somewhere southeast of Cambridge. And I thought I'd talk about this, I thought it'd be helpful. but it wasn't. Yeah, so what I said was, I said I've realised that I've been finding something uncomfortable, and what it is I've sort of I've projected something onto you that I need to own, basically. I need to live out. And what that was, it was about sort of altruism. And I said, in a slightly cack-handed way, not entirely unintentionally, but I said Arthur Pru had kind of really held that for me, but now he was kind of living a less sort of altruistic life. And actually, you know, there was another person on the end of that. I did it entirely sort of sincerely. And Arthur Pru found that really painful, for him, he was working in that area to sort of live a more altruistic life. He felt kind of completely unseen by someone who he'd given a lot to. But the way I related to that was, well, he shouldn't have reacted to that. He should have been okay with that. I confess. So in a way, what was happening here, yeah, there was kind of projection going on, but it was a bit like I was still within the projection. I kind of needed Arthur Priya to live something out for me, the sort of ideal Buddhist, the ideal Buddhist, if you like, for me to sort of have confidence in it. Actually, what I needed to do was stop doing that and live it out myself, have confidence that I could kind of live that out myself. So there's a few things that I want to kind of draw out from this. In a way, I was seeing Arthur Pru kind of edited through my needs. That's what happens, isn't it? It was kind of I did sort of see Arthur Pru, but actually it was a Arthur City version, a James version. That was Arthur City version then, wasn't it? Of Arthur Pru. And of course that was quite uncomfortable for him, because he sort of he didn't feel like I was really relating to him, which was kind of true at a certain level. What essentially was happening was, in a way, I wasn't putting friendship first. I didn't quite realise it at the time, but I needed to focus on my side of things, so I was getting resentful. And I needed to kind of look at that, but I thought I was justified in getting resentful that Arthur Pru was not being effective, not being the ideal Buddhist that he should be. That was kind of how I was seeing it. So as a friend, I would kind of look at that and kind of work on that. It's about kind of being a friend rather than having a friend. Yeah, so, that's what I wasn't really doing. I couldn't quite see it at the time, but that's what I wasn't really doing. And I think, in a way, that is kind of a key bit of learning for sort of how to relate to people who are more mature. Am I being a friend? There will be kind of complications that come up in friendship. You get involved with people, mistakes happen, misunderstandings. It's kind of part of the path. In some ways, we kind of even need them to happen. It's all too easy to expect people to be perfect. But actually, we need at some level to kind of to be brought down to see a real person with integrity who's not perfect. What that little sort of period, that difficult period, what I noticed was it helped me to relate to Sangharakshita. So Sangharakshita, at some level, I kind of related to him as sort of perfect, and that has got its own problems. Then what, you know, you hear stories, you think, oh God, well, I don't think he is perfect. Right, you know. It helped me sort of humanise that relationship, if you like. the issues that I kind of struggled with Sangharakshita sort of subsided, or kind of worked through in that sort of person-to-person relationship. There's another aspect to this, though, and that is referred to in the Pali Canon, in the Chula Punnama Sutta, where the Buddha asks his followers, he says, so do you think a person with no integrity can see whether another person has integrity or not, and they say, "No, Lord." And he says, "You're right." So there's this thing about actually when we have less experience, we can't necessarily see what further along the path looks like. It seems like we can, doesn't it? You sort of see someone, you think, wow, they're really impressive. But actually, as you get closer to them, you get to know them, you see their imperfections as well. And it's difficult to sort of really discern whether they're further along the path sometimes, even than you. And that's what the Buddha's saying. He's saying, actually, that's true. You need integrity to be able to perceive integrity. And I think this is the problem of the teacher, that essentially when you've got less experience, you can't really tell whether someone else has got more experience. That's putting it too strongly. You can tell to a certain extent, can't you? But to the extent that we sort of haven't got integrity ourselves, we're not able to sort of perceive integrity. We're not in a position to sort of judge whether someone else has integrity. Again, as I say, I think it's putting it too black and white, but I think there is a truth in that. I've certainly experienced that. I experienced it in relation to Artapriya, that I sort of thought that I was seeing him, but I wasn't. I simply wasn't kind of seeing him fully. I know that now because I see him more fully. But yeah, I think this is the problem of the teacher. How do you tell if someone is significantly further along the path than you or not? Sometimes that's not a question for us. It's completely straightforward and obvious. Other times it will be a question for us. So there is a kind of problem there. And what the Buddha says is, he says, lo and behold, that you ascertain someone's development through living with them, through having dealings with them, it says, through adversity, seeing them through adversity, and through seeing if their understanding is subtle, discerning. So there's a number of references to this in the Pali Canon. But that's what he says, which comes very close to friendship, living with, in that society would be understood as something akin to friendship. I just realised I've forgotten something, actually. I'll just nip back and say what it is. It was something Tejasiddhi said earlier on today. So in talking about sort of developing more expansive self through friendship, developing kind of positive emotion, this aspect of positive emotion, you develop that in a friendship, or one can develop that in a friendship. He was talking about his friendship with Chris Porter, and saying how it was a bit like there was a kind of stone in his heart that had started to kind of be heated, started to warm up through that friendship, that kind of deep friendship. They kind of spend a lot of time together. Interestingly, Ariyajaya was rejoicing in it. It's kind of lovely to be around them. And what Tejasiddhi said was he was noticing that actually that friendship was affecting how he's relating to other people. It's like actually you become a friend to one person, it affects your relationships with everybody. I think that's kind of quite an important point. Anyway, that was Tejasiddhi talking about that earlier on today. So back to vertical friendship. So, yeah, another thing I want to draw out is that actually there are sort of levels of vertical friendship, or Kalyana Mitrata, as it's sometimes called. So, in a way, I think it's just good to have kind of ordinary sort of hanging out friendship with people who are more experienced than you, just that sort of ordinary level. And then there's the level of kind of guidance that actually, you sort of respect them and respect their opinion, and you sort of receptive to them kind of, you know, helping you sort of see things more clearly, kind of work out what to do, how to go deeper in your own life. But really, where Kalyana Michitar is going is beyond that. It's going to a level which is simply seeing deeper living. So the only trouble with guidance, which I experienced actually, because Atapu was a very, very good guide, in some ways, I in a certain way, got into exchange, actually. I'll be your friend if you kind of, at a certain level, there's a kind of that element of that going on. And it's kind of, it's limited. So Kalyana Michitar is not, it's not like a teacher relationship. It's not like your geography teacher who can kind of tell you more about geography or Buddhism. That's not ultimately the nature of the relationship. That there is some of that in the relationship, that is fine. It's not like a kind of career mentor who can kind of help you develop more. It's deeper than that. What's happening is you're actually seeing deeper living. You're getting to know them enough to see, actually these guys are living more deeply than I am able to live. That's what Kalyana Michitar in essence is about, and everything else stems from that. So if there is guidance and it's helpful, great. If they can help you sort of understand Buddhism more fully, then great. So Sangharaksa talks about this in his lecture, is a guru necessary? And he says that's essentially what is important about a guru, that you're in contact with someone who is kind of living at a deeper level. How you learn from that is not quite as prescriptive as your geography teacher or your career mentor. The main thing is that you're sort of perceiving deeper living. I think in actual fact, probably we fall away from that quite regularly. But I think really to sort of see deeper living, it sounds like it's a visual thing. It's not. It's a relational thing. We see deeper living by developing friendship, by spending time with people. It just sort of goes in. You just sort of, you're around them. It just sort of goes in. Oh, yeah. So I just wanted to read this section to draw out a bit more about what that relationship is of seeing deeper in, because in a way it sounds a bit flat, if you like. There's kind of more to it than that. So this is a little section of a talk that David Foster Wallace gave to a bunch of graduate students, which you might have heard Jnana Varcher read in his talk. There's no such thing as not worshipping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And an outstanding reason for choosing some sort of god or spiritual type thing to worship is that pretty much anything else will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, then you will never have enough. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. Worship power. You will feel weak and afraid, and you will need ever more power over others to keep that fear at bay. worship your intellect, you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out. The insidious thing about these forms of worship is not that they're evil or sinful, it's that they are unconscious. They are default settings. They're the kind of worship you just gradually slip into day after day without ever being fully aware that that's what you're doing. And the world will not discourage you from operating on your default settings, because the world of men and money and power hums along quite nicely on the fuel of fear and contempt and frustration and craving and the worship of the self. The really important kind of freedom involves attention and awareness and discipline and effort and being able truly to care about other people and to sacrifice for them over and over in myriad petty little unsexy everyday ways every day. That is real freedom. The alternative is unconsciousness, the default setting, the rat race, the constant gnawing sense of having had and lost some infinite thing.
It's fantastic, isn't it?
So this thing about kind of worshipping, just keeping on time. yeah, that is, it's not a choice. That's the kind of nature, that's human nature. The only choice we have is kind of what to worship. That's putting it pretty strongly, isn't it? That's saying that it's kind of that's quite a lot of what we're actually like, what human life is like. and I think just as with kind of horizontal friendship, unless we're actually sort of bringing our Buddhist life, our sort of our transforming life into our friendships, we're not bringing it very far into our life. We're relational beings. So if we're not bringing our transformation, the Dharma, into our friendships, we're probably not bringing Buddhism very far into our life, basically. Similarly, I think with this kind of this aspect of us that kind of that worships, if we're not bringing that into relationship, into our relationships, worship's a strong word, isn't it? I want to say a bit more about that. But if we're not bringing that into our relationships, well, maybe it's not very engaged. That sort of capacity to worship, that sort of need to worship, is not actually coming very far into our Buddhist lives. Yeah. So, mean that our Buddhist lives are a bit flat, a bit kind of staid. Sometimes this area has been talked about in terms of discipleship. It's not a word that kind of gets me going, discipleship. I find it rather sort of cold at a certain level. But there's something about kind of seeing deeper living that is kind of, it's hard to put into words quite what that is like. There's a word that that Pingyur, some of you might have heard of Pingyur's praises, uses to talk about the Buddha, which is the word upasati, which means to sit close by, to go after, to attend, to follow, to serve, to honour, to worship. I like that. I like that much better. To follow, to serve, to sit close by. It's kind of more. It says more about kind of what you do. Sometimes in the order, there's been discussion, arguments about not arguments, kind of debate about. About discipleship, you know, are we disciples, are we not? I don't think the debate is really about that. I think that gets stuck on the word. I think what's actually happening is that this aspect, this human need, if you like, is alive in the order. That's what I see. I see people who do look up to, do kind of serve at some level, do go after, do follow Bante, other sort of more experienced Buddhists. I certainly experience that. That's what makes sense to me in terms of my relationship with Artha Priya, with Ratnagosha, with Amoghavangsa. For me, there's a sort of sense of something alive. Something I would say I kind of follow them. So what I mean by that is not that I follow everything that they say. It's not that I follow all of their advice. Their advice is often very good. actually, one of them was kind of giving me a bit of advice a bit ago, and I realised actually I can see how that works out in their life, and I can see that they can do that, but it's not quite right for me. In the past, I must admit, I would have been kind of rather keen to sort of assert, well, I'm not sure I agree with that, you know, kind of assert my opinion. In a way, that was just a sort of lack of sort of true independence. I think we need sort of true independence to be, you know, whatever we call it, a disciple, to kind of follow someone. We need to be kind of truly independent. Now, I noticed in this interaction, there's just kind of no... There was no, what might you call it, no barb or anything like that in this. You know, I can take it or leave it. So, it's not about I follow their guidance. it's about this sort of aspect of seeing kind of deeper living. I perceive... deeper living, and that's sort of expressed in, you know, Ratnagosha Artha Priya, many different qualities, but in some ways I find it more clear to see in their kind of less obvious qualities. Sometimes it's in their just sort of their sort of ease with which they can talk about their failings, their weakness. In some ways their sort of how well they've done their failings are kind of not what is most important for them. There's something kind of deeper going on in their lives. So it's kind of in these little sort of almost insignificant sort of qualities that I myself sort of experience deeper living. I wanted to say one last thing. I'm kind of going over time, I must admit, but I wanted to talk about Sangharakshita. I wanted to just include him because I think, in a way, Sangharakshita is our sort of lineage of Kalyana Mitratar. It's very evident with me, to me, with Artha Priya, Ratnagosha, Amoghavangsa, Padmavantara, that. What I look up to, what I follow in them, has been stimulated, sparked off by their engagement with Sangharakshita. It's indivisible, really, from their contact with Sangharakshita. Sometimes I hear people say that they find other order members, they find Sangharakshita's kind of explanation of things a bit kind of dry, a bit hard going. And I can understand that. And that they prefer kind of other order members who kind of come later. They find they can relate to that more. And I totally understand that. And I think it's sort of missing quite what's going on. Or I think it can be missing quite what's going on. It's a bit like saying, well, I love Mozart, but I don't love Bach. And on the face of it, that's fine. I don't love Bach. Sorry, I said that a bit quiet, didn't I? Mozart was reading Bach. Mozart was who he was, partly because of Bach. It's like what we see is the different individuals, but actually that's not really what's going on. What is happening is more like lineage. So I wanted to just sort of include that in this, that I think what I follow in these men is indivisible from Sangharakshita. so much of what we know, the best of what we know, has been learned from others, isn't it? It's not a very common way of looking at things in this day and age. It's kind of, it runs counter to our way of looking at things. I'm just going to finish with another reading, a well-known reading. So this is from Tsongkhapa Pa's Dual Ornament of Liberation. Since at the beginning of our career, it is impossible to be in touch with the Buddhas or with Bodhisattvas living on a high level of spirituality. We have to meet with ordinary human beings as spiritual friends. As soon as the darkness caused by our deeds has lightened, we can find bodhisattvas on a high level of spirituality. Then, when we have risen above the great preparatory path, we can find the Nimanakaya of the Buddha. Finally, as soon as we live on a high spiritual level, we can meet with the Sambhogakaya as a spiritual friend.